Car chases, assassinations, explosions, silent bombs from a seemingly empty sky, secret government deliberations creating literal kill lists. Yeah, this is all real. And what's more, they feature U.S. citizens on both ends, the hunters and the hunted. Find out if the U.S.'s drone killing program is legal on today's episode of The End of the Law. Hello and welcome to The End of the Law, the show that looks at what happens when the extremes of humanity meet the fringes of the law. Every other week, I pick out some news story or some major world event and examine it to figure out how the law deals with modern messes. I'm Grant Shubin, and I'm in charge. Today's episode is about the U.S. government's Predator drone program, about the international legal support for the program, and about the legal precedent the program sets up at the global level. Before all that, though, a few orders of business. First, Radio Free Brooklyn is now on Patreon, a community and website where you can help support us by becoming a patron and donating as little as $1 a month. And for real, any support is incredibly helpful. Radio Free Brooklyn is totally volunteer-maintained, and the people keeping the lights on here work themselves to the bone to keep this ship afloat. So if you like this show or any of the other 55 original programs on Radio Free Brooklyn, head over to patreon.com/Radio Free Brooklyn and become a patron. Okay, second, please email me. Let me know what you think of the show. Let me know if there's anything that you're especially curious about. Let me know anything. The show's email is theendofthelaw@gmail.com. And I'd really like to get your feedback about episodes and topics or whatever else comes to mind. And finally, recapping and filling in a bit more from last week's episode. Last week, we covered discrimination against women by way of sexual and gender-based violence and conflict. And, well, really, it narrowly covered how enforcement of international law and the laws of war is stronger for men than it is for women. In painting that picture, we looked at ISIS's genocide of the Yazidi ethnic and religious minority in northern Iraq and how their specific targeting of women and girls for certain types of treatment amounts to genocide. That is, normally when we think about genocide, we think of mass killings on a huge scale, thousands, millions of people. But mass killings are only one of five ways to commit genocide, the others being intentional infliction of serious physical or mental harm, imposing conditions to bring about the total destruction of a group, imposing measures to prevent births within a group, and forcibly transferring children from one group to another group. ISIS is doing all these things against Yazidi women and girls. It's separating them according to their age and marital status, executing the elderly women, selling others into slavery, forcibly marrying them, forcibly converting them, forcibly impregnating them, and doing so openly and with the aim of destroying Yazidis as a group. This is genocide. Actually, each of these things fit into every form of genocide. But thus far, it has been treated as genocide. Why? Well, one answer we talked about is the strong legal framework of genocide law. When it's confirmed that a genocide is happening, countries have to do everything reasonably in their power to prevent, suppress, and punish it. And countries really aren't all that psyched to do that. Generally speaking, countries don't like to be forced to do anything, especially if it requires intervention and it's in an area of little tactical or geopolitical benefit. So unsurprisingly then, we find a major reluctance on the part of world leaders to actually call something a genocide. But there's a more nefarious cause as well. The fact of the matter is, sexual and gender-based violence are not treated with the same gravitas or urgency as other crimes that specifically target men and soldiers. As I talked about on the show, war has traditionally been thought of as the man's realm. Men fight wars, men solve wars, and women aren't relevant on the battlefield. Though this is certainly changing, that general discriminatory paradigm is still with us, particularly in how we view women as victims of conflict. This is something the organization I work for focuses on a bunch. The Global Justice Center has four main projects aimed at ending discrimination against women in war. One of which is on gender and genocide, and it covers discriminatory enforcement of genocide law. Another of our projects is similar, but focuses on the use of rape as a specific weapon of war. That is, rape as a weapon to demean or kill and erode the communal fabric of the enemy. Rape used as a weapon of war isn't treated like a weapon at all, actually. The international community completely fails to treat tactical rape like any other illegal weapon, like chemical weapons or starvation. Think about the Syrian government's ongoing and widespread systemic use of sexual violence against women belonging to rebel groups and Assad's use of chemical weapons. Or even this week, news reports about starvation in Syria are everywhere. Sexual violence as a weapon is hardly talked about by world leaders compared to a literal disarming of Assad's chemical weapons arsenal. The difference in enforcement can be traced plainly to discrimination against women and their value as victims of war. The Global Justice Center's third project covers the lack of abortion access for women and girls impregnated by war rape. Put really simply, the U.S. attaches a ban to its foreign aid, barring abortions for anyone, including victims of war rape. And because the U.S. is the largest funder of humanitarian aid worldwide, this policy ends up kind of towing the global line. It sets the status quo. Problem is, war rape victims are entitled to abortion services under the Geneva Conventions, which guarantee all necessary medical care with no difference in outcome between men and women. So the U.S.'s banning of a specific treatment only needed by women, in addition to violating international law, discriminates against women. And finally, the Global Justice Center's final project combines themes from each of these others in works in Burma or Myanmar on institutionalizing gender equality in a new democracy and one emerging from conflict. If any of this interests you or inspires you, if you want to know more, hell, if you want to donate, go to globaljusticecenter.net and check us out. One thing we don't work on, though, is the topic of today's show, the U.S. drone killing programs. But what even am I talking about? What is the drone killing program, or sometimes called the Predator drone program? Well, like lots of these scary governmental power stories, it starts with September 11th. Well, actually, it starts with the Authorization to Use Military Force, or the AUMF, passed by Congress in the weeks after the 9/11 attacks. The AUMF authorized the American president to, quote, use all necessary and appropriate force against those nations, organizations, or persons he determined planned, authorized, committed, or aided the terrorist attacks that occurred on September 11, 2001, or harbored such organizations or persons in order to prevent future acts of international terrorism against the United States by such nations, organizations, or persons. Basically, it was a free pass for the president to go militarily nuts. It was a de facto declaration of war. And it kind of had to be, since only Congress can declare war, and Congress hasn't done so since the Korean War. Anyway, the AUMF has been the legal foundation for the U.S.'s military involvement in Afghanistan, as well as campaigns in Somalia, Syria, Yemen, and probably elsewhere. It's unique for being amazingly broad. It doesn't have any geographical or time limits. It's basically the codification of the war on terror. But it's also unique for coinciding perfectly with technological advancements. At exactly the right time that the U.S. saw fit to canvass the globe in the secret hunt for small groups of people to kill, we developed the way to do it, the unmanned aerial vehicle, or the drone. The marriage of the unpredictable need to kill quickly and secretly and the unprecedented ability to do so proved too much for President George Bush to resist, who began ordering drone strikes on specific individuals in various countries in the Middle East. Not to be outdone, Obama has kept up and actually increased the number of these assassination strikes. In fact, apparently Bush ordered around 50. Obama has ordered just over 500. And maybe the most astonishing thing about Obama's drone legacy is that he's actually ordered and had killed a U.S. citizen in Yemen. Sure, the American in question, Anwar al-Awlaki, was a highly sought-after al-Qaeda operative that was believed to be planning some future attack in the U.S., but still, he was an American. He basically got no due process, no notice, no attempt at capture, no specific declaration. He was just killed. So how it works is this. Some name gets submitted to a secret group of intelligence and military and other administration people who considers whether that person should be killed. It's not entirely clear what they consider, but presumably it includes the threat the person poses, their affiliation with terrorist organizations, the country they are in, the likelihood of success, and hopefully the legality of the attack. Once a certain person has been approved as a target, the CIA takes over and actually conducts the operation that targets and kills the individual. So that's the program. But is it legal? Well, that's a very, very difficult question to answer since very, very little is known about the program. The Obama administration has hinted at a secret memo that establishes his legal authority to carry out these killings, and government officials have talked about some of these principles, which unsurprisingly is exactly what I want to get into. Before I do, though, I need to note that the program is completely practically and legally novel. When I talk about the ends of the law, specific killings in a war that has the loosest of time and geographical boundaries is exactly what I'm talking about. Whether or not you or anyone else buys the legal argument for the program's validity, there's no doubt that the Obama administration is talking over itself to try to prove its legitimacy. So, is it legal? There are three broad legal regimes under which the government may assert the program is allowed. One, the law of armed conflict. Two, the international law of self-defense. And three, the law of counterterrorism. So what does the law of armed conflict have to say about targeted drone killings? And actually, just to be clear, the law of armed conflict is also sometimes called the law of war or international humanitarian law, and it regulates the conduct of military operations during war. And believe it or not, when states fight against each other, they more or less follow these rules. They've been developed over hundreds of years. And really, the first thing to know about the law of war is that it breaks wars into two broad categories: international armed conflicts, which are armed conflicts between two or more countries, and non-international armed conflicts, which are conflicts between a government, like the US, and some non-state armed group like Al-Qaeda. Where the law of armed conflict applies, targeted killing is fine. That's how you carry out war. You target and kill people. But in order for it to be okay, you have to target combatants or fighters. Most of the time, these people are on the opposite side's military. But in non-international armed conflicts, like the one where the US is killing by drone, combatants can also include civilians who are directly participating in hostilities or continuously performing some combat function. And this muddies the waters a little bit, and it certainly makes the war more difficult to carry out. Still, under the laws of war, any legitimate military target can be attacked, regardless of the immediate risk he may pose. The law also requires that any armed attack must be militarily necessary, and any military advantage must be proportionate to the collateral damage or accidental damage done. Really, all these rules mean is that no more force than is reasonably necessary may be employed, and measures must be taken to minimize the harm to civilians. And like I mentioned before, these laws are very well respected. They're followed. Where the debate comes in is the scope of the application of the laws of armed conflict, where it applies and where it doesn't apply, where you can target and kill people and where you can't. There's no doubt that the military operations the U.S. launched in Afghanistan in 2001 as a result of the AUMF amounted to an armed conflict under international law. What's less clear, however, is whether the hostilities between the U.S. and Al-Qaeda meet the threshold to count as an armed conflict outside of Afghanistan. If not, the laws of war do not apply and the drone program would not likely be legal. The most widely regarded definition of armed conflict comes from the international court set up in the wake of the war in the Balkans in the 1990s. That court said that the existence of armed conflict, quote, focuses on two aspects of conflict, the intensity of the conflict and the organization of the parties to the conflict, end quote. The court also said that for non-international armed conflicts, these two factors, intensity and organization, are used to separate armed conflicts from banditry, unorganized and short-lived insurrections, and terrorist activities, which are not the subject of international law. Under this definition, Al-Qaeda, a terrorist group, might not be sufficiently organized. It doesn't really have and hasn't really had a cohesive command or control structure, and it definitely hasn't been able to carry out protracted military operations. Again, if the fight between Al-Qaeda and the U.S. is something other than armed conflict in the legal sense, then that would mean that the U.S. cannot justify its drone killings under the law of armed conflict and its general permission to target combatants. It would mean that the peacetime rules apply and that instead of killing combatants, the U.S. would just be murdering people. And that's bad. And even assuming that Al-Qaeda was organized enough to raise our fight with them to an armed conflict, there's still the issue about whether armed conflict is limited to geographical bounds or if it can be everywhere. Like, historically, wars that looked like modern-day non-international armed conflicts like the American Civil War were typically treated to extend to the entire territory of one of the fighting parties. That is, not everywhere. But in today's environment of extremist groups that transcend international borders and conducting their hostilities, this rule is being rethought. And it's an open question whether there is, as a legal matter, a geography to war. When all is said and done on the law of armed conflict and drone killings, it's a huge gray area. It's not at all clear whether the U.S.'s conflict with Al-Qaeda amounts to an armed conflict in the international legal sense. And it's not clear that if it is, whether it's limited to the territory under Al-Qaeda's control or extend to other countries and continents. So with all that confusion in mind, let's turn to another area of law that might legitimate the U.S.'s targeted drone killings: self-defense under international law. Sovereign states have a right to self-defense when they are attacked, whether or not they're at war or whether or not the attack was during war. Actually, this right is enshrined in the UN Charter, which is supposed to be the go-to legal framework for whether or not armed force is allowed. The charter generally bars states from using or threatening to use force against another state, and that's no lightly taken rule. Territorial incursions or invasions are maybe the most serious issues in international law. These speak directly to the integrity and the sovereignty of the state invaded. Just look at what happened when Russia flew over Turkey's airspace. Turkey knew Russia wasn't going to bomb in Turkey, but Turkey shot Russia's plane down anyway because it wouldn't stand for the affront. Still, despite the strong rules about using force against another state, the UN Charter does reserve the, quote, inherent right of individual or collective self-defense if an armed attack occurs against a member of the UN. If read really literally, this would mean that the right to self-defense wouldn't kick in until after an attack took place, meaning that the US would have trouble targeting terrorists who are in the act of planning an attack. But such a narrow reading is usually pushed aside in favor of the rule of self-defense as articulated in the 1837 Caroline case. There, British troops attacked a private American ship, the Caroline, while it was moored at night on the New York side of Niagara Falls. The Brits claimed that the Caroline was being used to support Canadian insurgents against British colonial rule. The U.S. did not take the attack lightly and demanded an apology and repayment. In the course of the diplomatic negotiations that followed, it was settled that intruding the territory of another state in self-defense is only justified when, quote, the necessity of self-defense is instant, overwhelming, and leaving no choice of means and no moment for deliberation. So that's way more detail than necessary. I just really like that case because it's the classic Atlantic belligerents, the U.S., the U.K., and Canada. Really, the take-home from the Caroline case is that there's generally three conditions to a state invoking the right to self-defense: necessity, proportionality, and immediacy. Looking at drones and setting aside whether attacks are necessary and proportional to the threatened harm posed by the people killed, are they rooted in immediacy? Is the need, as required under Caroline, instant, overwhelming, and leaving no choice of means or no moment of deliberation? And it doesn't really look like it. From the information that's out there, the people targeted by drone attacks while allegedly planning attacks against the U.S. are not necessarily anywhere near actually carrying out those attacks. That's part of the problem with this area of law. What's considered, quote, immediate is not defined and hardly talked about. So to get around all this uncertainty, instead of looking to immediate threat of an attack, the drone program kind of turns the immediacy requirement on its head and looks instead at whether the window to kill someone is immediate. When deciding whether or not to carry out a drone killing, the U.S. turns Caroline around and takes into consideration that if it doesn't kill the target immediately, will it be able to kill them in the future? If the answer to that question is no, then the killing is immediate. Or they say it's immediate, at least. I should also note that there are two exceptions to this rule, two situations where a state can get away with using force against another state without needing to rely on self-defense. The first is where the state being attacked is actually given consent. Think of a situation like if Syria just happened to invite the U.S. to bomb ISIS. Obviously, that isn't going to happen, but if it did, the U.S. wouldn't be violating international law by using force against Syria, because when it comes down to it, there would be no incursion. Syria would be embracing the use of force. The second exception is similar and applies when the state that's invaded is injured or unwilling to remove the threat to its territory. The example here would be like something if ISIS got so powerful that Syria's government was unable to fight them, or like in Afghanistan in 2001 where the Taliban was unwilling to fight or remove al-Qaeda. And that's kind of the key point. It's a relatively high bar to constitute unwilling to remove a threat. Getting around the self-defense rule in this context is more akin to asking for self-help than it is anything else. While the first exception basically never applies for drone killings, the second, the unable or unwilling to do something exception, that's one vaguely used by the government in relying on certain killings. And the fact of the matter is, though, the drone killing programs are a major source of tension between the U.S. and countries in the region, particularly Pakistan, one of our purported allies in the war on terror. The program definitely pushes the self-help metaphor to its limits. So what about the third area law that might save the program, counterterrorism? In brief, this is a long shot for legality. Prior to 9/11, counterterrorism operations were considered the province of law enforcement. They were like other military operations against non-state actors like pirates. And the rules for using deadly force in law enforcement are those that exist in whatever state the operation is conducted in. If an operation is in Malta, the law of law enforcement using deadly force in Malta would apply, which obviously makes counterterrorism a difficult area for the government to justify the drone program. It's just too variable and too individualized. None of this bodes all that well for the Obama administration, but what do they say about it? Well, they kind of mash up language from the law of war and the law of self-defense in some attempt at claiming a Frankenstein super law. For example, Harold Coe, who was the legal advisor for the State Department, one time stated, "As a matter of international law, the U.S. is in armed conflict with al-Qaeda as well as the Taliban in response to the horrific 9/11 attacks and may use force consistent with the inherent right to self-defense under international law." This explanation doesn't really do much other than generally appeal to two areas of law that might support the program. And this is intentional. And it's intentional because the legal bases we've discussed for the drone program under the laws of war and the laws of self-defense are thin. So what's the big deal? Who cares if the U.S. is operating in some poorly defined legal twilight zone? Well, we all should. So what do we know? Well, in a way, we know a little and we know a lot. We know that under the AUMF, the U.S. carries out targeted killings of specific individuals. We know that there are three broad areas of law that might legitimate these killings. First is the law of armed conflict, which regulates how war is carried out and permits killing of combatants and fighters. But the law of armed conflict only applies in conflict, and it's entirely unclear if the hostilities between al-Qaeda and the U.S. outside of Afghanistan constitute a conflict. In fact, they might not count as a conflict because al-Qaeda, especially in the last several years, is essentially in disarray and unable to coordinate or carry out attacks. The second area of law that might justify the drone killing program is the law of self-defense. Generally, under international law, states can't attack other states unless it's in self-defense. In order to use self-defense, the use of force must be necessary, proportional, and in response to an immediate threat. And it's that last qualifier that's a bit of a problem for the U.S. since it's targeting and killing people that are planning attacks in the U.S. but whose attacks probably aren't any immediate threat. Oftentimes, the attacks might be attenuated or quite poorly formed. And the third area of law that might save the program is the law of counterterrorism, which for our purposes is the law of using deadly force in law enforcement. And looking at each state is just far too individualized to be a reliable justification for the drone program. So what don't we know? Well, when it comes down to it, we don't really know if the drone program is legal. Everything we've talked about are the ways in which it might be legal, and whatever secret memo the Obama administration claims to have justifying the program definitely brings these things up. But what I've tried to point out throughout the show is that these arguments are somewhat legally flimsy. And that's exactly why the Obama administration mashes together language from each of these legal regimes in trying to explain why the program is legal. It's because they've got somewhat weak arguments. If you mash them all together and use language about conflict when talking about self-defense, it sounds more legit. But honestly, that's not what's most troubling about the program. Sure, it might be legal, it might not be legal. And of course, it would be bad if it weren't. But it's enough of a gray area for the U.S. to kind of just fly under the radar, if you will. And that's what's most scary about it. And why that's scary is for two very important reasons. First, international law is a permissive system. That is, under international law, unless something is explicitly prohibited, it's treated as allowed. And under this permissive system, the law of armed conflict, self-defense, and counterterrorism have all painted enough of a legal picture for the U.S. more or less to get by. And because it's getting by, it's creating a norm, which is the second reason why the program is so scary. And we've talked about this before. There are two main sources of international law. There's treaty law and there's customary international law. Treaty law is basically just that, treaties, contracts between two or more states. But customary international law is a bit different. In order for something to be customary international law, it must be some generally followed custom which is followed out of a sense of legal duty. Generally, customary international laws start by having one or a few states do something. That something might turn into a regional or localized practice. Eventually, that practice might become a custom that's followed and expected to be followed. And ultimately, that custom may become a norm that carries the weight of law. And this progression is the danger of the U.S.'s drone killing program. At first, we were the only country with armed drones. Now we're one of nine, alongside the U.K., France, Israel, Nigeria, Iraq, Iran, and China. And add to that the 11 countries that are developing armed drones and will likely have them in the near future. Also, we're now one of five countries that have used armed drones in combat. Drones, even armed drones, aren't necessarily a bad thing. What's cause for alarm, though, is the fact that the U.S. started using them after 9/11 and at a time of unparalleled fear. That fear somewhat obviously fed into our policy behind using drones, and namely the fact that we're using them against countries we are not at war with, against people who are selected in secret and who do not necessarily pose an immediate risk to us, and sometimes even against our own citizens. That's the momentum we've set, and that's the course we've normalized for other countries in developing and using drones, and that's the legal norm we risk at establishing if we continue down this path. That's why the drone program is scary. That's it for today's show. Before I go, though, I'd be blowing if I didn't mention there's a huge issue about drones that I didn't talk about, and that's whether the U.S. can kill an American citizen by drone under the Constitution, or whether the government is violating due process and killing an American citizen without some judicial review or public disclosure about its criteria and process. Ultimately, the answer to that question lays in the balance between the government's interest in keeping us safe and the target's interest in staying alive, but I'll save that for another time. Like I mentioned a bit earlier, Radio Free Brooklyn is now on Patreon, which is a way for listeners like you to support the people keeping the station going. Go to www.patreon.com/Radio Free Brooklyn to sign up to be a patron for as little as $1 a month. Also, send me emails. In 2 weeks, one of the brightest dudes I know is going to come in and we're going to talk about modern slavery. After that, I want to do a show on Sharia law. I want to do another on stripping citizenship. I want to do another on LGBT rights internationally. But if you want to hear something different, let me know at theendofthelaw@gmail.com. I'm Grant Shubin. You're listening to Radio Free Brooklyn. This is The End of the Law, and this is the end of the show. Thanks for listening.